John chapter 1, verses 1 and 14. Reads, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us." I think all of us would agree that this scripture is speaking of Jesus. But I've always understood and thought in my mind of the Word to be the collection of words about Jesus, the gospel of Christ, the plan that God had for mankind. But what if there is one word? What if it's not meaning the collection of words, but what if there is the Word? What do you think that word would be? What one word sums up what was in the beginning with God? That God is. What one word sums it up? I think John gives us a clue in his first epistle, 1 John chapter 4 and verse 9. "And this was manifested," or made aware, made known to man, "manifested the love of God toward us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him." If there was one word that would describe Jesus Christ, I believe it would have to be love. It would have to be love. One word that describes God, it is love. John tells us that God is love. So if we go back to that passage, John chapter 1, verses 1 and 14, and we replace the word with love, let's read it again. "In the beginning was love, and love was with God, and love was God, and love was made flesh and dwelt among us." It fits beautifully, doesn't it? Think about the passages that use the word love. John 3 and 16, "God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." Speaking of Jesus, Matthew writes this, "And he shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." Matthew 1 and 21. So God's plan of love is to save us. It's to save mankind from sin. Now what this brings to mind is sort of a theme that we're going to use through the week. Man is sinful. We are sinful. We make mistakes. We are not perfect. Not a single one of us in here is perfect. No one ever will be. Only Christ can claim that. Man is sinful, but man needs God. God can't have anything to do with sin. So we see the dilemma. There is sin with man, but God loves man. So God had a plan. He had a plan, and Jesus is that plan. He is the way. He told us. He says, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me." Jesus is the plan. And friends, the story of Jesus Christ, the story of his life, is the greatest story that's ever been told on the face of this earth. The best one ever. We sing the words, "Tell me the story of Jesus. Write on my heart every word." We sang the song tonight, "Give me the Bible, holy message shining." The story of Jesus is the greatest one ever told, because it is the greatest story of love that can ever be written. And to understand his story, we need to understand the Old Testament. The reason is because the beginning of the story of Christ does not begin in 4 B.C. It begins in the beginning. So the story of Christ is not a 33-year period of his life, but it's the entire span of time leading up to the point of where he came to this earth, walked on this earth, went to the cross, and died for our sins, for my sins and for your sins, the ones that we deserve to die for, the ones that nailed him to the cross. That is his story. And that's what we're going to try to share with you this week. The story of God and man. We will start in the book of Genesis, and we will conclude, go through all through the Old Testament. Now, what this will not be is a group of Old Testament stories. We're going to try to tell this as the story of the Old Testament. It's going to be quick. It's got to be quick. But we want you to see the big picture. We want you to see how things fit together, because we know the stories, the individual stories, but sometimes we forget how they fit together. Sometimes we forget how beautiful it is, this plan that God put together for mankind. Sometimes we forget how wonderful it is that we have the opportunity to be Christians and to call God our Father and what that means. And so we're going to try to remind us of this week. We will not go book by book through the Old Testament, because the Old Testament is not chronological. It's grouped by the type of books. The first five books is called the Pentateuch, or the five books of Moses. Then there's the historical books from Joshua through Esther. Then you have the poetical books, the book of Job through Song of Solomon. And you have major prophets, Isaiah through Daniel. You have the minor prophets, Hosea through Malachi. Chronologically, it is the Pentateuch, the first five books, with Job in there shortly after the flood. And if you just look at the list, Job comes around the middle of the Old Testament. Another example, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, all of those are around the middle, towards the back, towards the end of the middle, I guess. But they actually, according to chronology, would be around 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st and 1st Kings and 1st Chronicles. Nehemiah is in the middle of the Old Testament. If you look at the list of the books, and Nehemiah comes at the end. So it is not in chronological order. So we will be bouncing around at time from time from this book to that book to try to tell the story of God and man, the story of the Old Testament. Sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees, and I know we've all heard that saying. Sometimes we get caught up in the individual stories, and what we're trying to do, again, is to back out and show you the forest, show you the whole picture, so that each one of our spirits can be uplifted and revived with the understanding and the knowledge of what God has done for us and what plan He had put together from the beginning of time to save me and to save you. Tonight we're going to cover the conception of God's people. We'll be talking about the families that led up to becoming the nation of Israel. These are the patriarchs. We'll be covering the book of Genesis tonight. Like I said, we're going to have to move quickly through the book of Genesis. But it's a beautiful story. Beautiful story. Some sad stories. But there's some beautiful stories when you see the whole picture of how everything fits together to get God's people where they need to be so that He can show His power. We call it the conception of God's people, because this is a family. This is the beginning. God needed to impact the world. He needed to make a difference in the world, and one family couldn't have made a difference at that time because they had to conquer nations. So He had to start with a family. He had to begin with a family, and then from that family was born the nation of Israel. And that's what God will cover tomorrow night. We're going to alternate through the evening. I will be continuing on Tuesday with the lesson from the Judges. Dad will continue Wednesday with the first three kings. Thursday will be the divided kingdom. And Friday will conclude, Dad will conclude with lessons from captivity. So I hope that you enjoy it. It's been a very wonderful study for both he and I to put this together. We appreciate the congregation having the faith in us to be able to call on us to put this together for this meeting. And we look forward to it. And we hope that each of you will fall in love with these stories all over again, like we have. And that you will come and you will learn, and it will make a difference in your life as it has in ours. So beginning tonight, the conception of God's people, beginning in Genesis chapter 1. Again, I reiterate, we have to go quick because there's no way that we can spend all the time that we would want to on each story. And that's not the point, because if you look at this timeline, and we know you can't read it, but just for argument's sake and for an illustration, this is the beginning of time. I will make a disclaimer. Dad and I didn't do this. We found it. Another man had spent years of his life creating this, and his son made it computer-generated where he could print it. And starting at the beginning of time with Adam, and you notice there's very few lines up here because it was following Adam's lineage all the way through the end of Genesis. The arrows show you the time period that we'll be covering this evening. Straight down at the 6 o'clock position is the time of Christ. That's what we have the star there for. And then they continue all the way through current day 2000. It's a very interesting map, and I hope you'll take time to come up and look at it. We can't show you all the details there, but we want you to have the idea of what's going on. And when you come to look at it, you'll notice that there's different colors. And the different colors are the lineages of the families of the three sons of Noah. And it shows you, and it brings it forward to today. And it's very interesting, very enlightening. So we begin in the beginning. There was the creation, Genesis chapters 1 and 2. The first day, God created life. Second day, sky and water. But the waters were separated. There was a firmament of water above and water below. Day 3, he created the land and the seas. All the waters were gathered together and the dry land appeared. Day 4, he created the sun and the moon and the stars to govern the day and the night, the seasons and the years, and we're experiencing that right now because the sun's going down behind us and we see it. It's the same sun that God set in motion on day 4. Day 5, he created the fish and the birds to fill the sea and to fill the air. Day 6, he created the animals to fill the earth and man to care for the earth. The man also had another important purpose that the animals do not have, and that purpose is to commune with God, because we are made in the image of God. The animals are not. And we have a higher purpose, but sometimes we don't live up to that purpose. We need to. We need to take that purpose that we are here for and live up to it, to the purpose that God has given us here on this earth. On the seventh day, he rested and declared that it was very good. Very good. There was no sin. It was a perfect world. We all would love to see what the Garden of Eden was like. How beautiful it must have been. There was no weeds. It never had to be worked. It never had to be gardened. There was plenty of food. Adam and Eve were there in harmony with themselves and God. They would never die. Then we don't get very far in the story of God and man before sin appears. Satan shows up in the form of the serpent. And there's three things that he used, the same three things that John told us about in 1 John the 2nd chapter. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life are the same three things that Satan used against Eve in the Garden of Eden. The lust of the flesh, she saw that the fruit was good for food. Lust of the eyes, it was pleasant to the eyes. It must have been something that, like chocolate cake, you know. It makes you just want to reach out there and eat it, okay? It's hard to turn it down. It was pleasant to the eyes. But the pride of life also, it was desire to make one wise. And Satan's first attempt, his first at-bat that's recorded, he may have tried to get Adam to fall earlier, but that's not recorded. The first one recorded, he pulled out all three of his weapons, and he used them against Eve. And those are the same three things that he uses against us today. Ever since the beginning of time, he's not changed. Some of his tactics change, but the main plan that he uses against us does not change. Once we lived in a fallen world, it's no surprise that murder entered. Jealousy entered into the world. Cain and Abel were familiar with this story, how that Abel's sacrifice was more acceptable to God than Cain's was, and Cain was angry, and he was wroth, and he slew his brother. Why was Abel's sacrifice more acceptable to God? Some of you may have saw the question that was up before church. Because his sacrifice was by faith. Even as early as Genesis chapter 4. We don't learn that it's from faith until we read over in Hebrews. But when we look backwards, faith was a requirement all the way back in the book of Genesis. In the very beginning, they had to have faith. Cain didn't, and his sacrifice was not accepted by God. We continue through time. 1,656 years after the creation. Conservative estimate, this time, man lived much longer then. Adam lived some 930 years roughly. Methuselah, the oldest man alive, lived 969 years. But think about this. What if Adam was created 40 years old or 50 years old? It's possible that he, in effect, could have been like the oldest person, even though Methuselah lived longer. We don't know how old, so to speak, Adam was when he was created. We assume he was created full grown. Nonetheless, 1,656 years, conservative estimates of the world's population at that time is 235 million. And that's conservative. That's down on the low side where each family had something like 2 to 4 children. And we know they had probably way more than that. Current population of the United States is around 300 million. So what we're basically looking at is the annihilation of the United States by a flood, and only 8 people are saved. I would guess that there's close to 100 here tonight. So not even all of us. Not even all of us in our families. 8 people out of well over 200 million is all that was saved through the flood. But then God did something after the flood was over that we still see today. He put a rainbow in the clouds as a promise to the world, as a promise to you, and a promise to me that he would never again completely destroy the world by water, but it will be preserved to the last day when he will destroy it by fire. And we can still see that. Just as the same way that we still see the sun setting behind us, and we see the change in the days and the years, we still see the rainbow. And all of these promises, these things that happened back in Genesis, they're still going on today. Not long after Noah exited from the ark, God gave them the charge to be fruitful and multiply, to repopulate the earth. And they did that. Man's population grew, and they came to a time where they all knew the story of the flood because they were only maybe 1 or 2 generations away from it. They remembered the story of the flood. They were all together as one people. And they said, let us come together and make brick and mortar, and we have slime for mortar. Let us build a tower that will reach under the heavens and make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered. They were trying to make something of themselves as a people and reach forth unto God. And you know, it's just sticks in my mind what God said. He said, let us go down and confuse the tongues, because now nothing that they imagine will be held back from them, basically, along those lines. They can accomplish and achieve anything that they set their minds to. And that was over building a tower. Look at all the things that we've accomplished today. We've walked on the moon. And as amazing as it is, the day that we walked on the moon in 1969 was still the day when computers took up a large portion of the room. Things have changed. It's amazing to see what we've accomplished. How much has changed over the past 100 years. And with the growth of the internet and people being able to share ideas all over the world, it's almost as if languages are coming back together, because we're able to communicate. We're able to share ideas as one global people all over the world. We could go get online and we could chat with somebody in India with a conversion software that would change the language for us. I think that we need to be careful with our lives, because the world is getting evil, much like it was in Noah's day. And God destroyed it then, and he's promised us that he will destroy it again. So God confused the tongues. And in the times of Peleg, we're told that the world was divided. I believe that to be the time when the continents were separated from what scientists call the Pangaea, the supercontinent. But at that point, they were divided. Man wants to tell us, science would like to tell us, that that would take millions and millions of years. I want to believe by faith that God can do it in however amount of time he wants to. But the continents were divided, the peoples were divided across the earth. We move forward in time to the time of Abraham. Abraham lived in a time when polytheism, or the worship of multiple gods, creative gods, idols, basically, was rampant. For Abraham to believe in one God was an oddity of that time. For him to believe that there was one God that created the earth, that there was one God that destroyed the earth, and that there was one God that had a plan for the earth, was different than everybody else around him. They believed in many gods. They created their own gods. They had the gods of the sun, the god of the rain, the god of fertility. They had all these different gods to try to explain things and that they worshiped. And they chose how they wanted to worship them. But Abraham was faithful, even though his father wasn't. We find out later that his own father was an idolater. But Abraham believed in one God. Now, how did Abraham know about one God? Well, if you look back at the genealogy, it's very possible that there was only two people between Adam and Abraham to tell him the story firsthand. Adam overlived Methuselah by around 250 years. Methuselah overlived Noah, and Noah lived to within about 2 years of when Abraham was born, and Shem lived until 75 years after Abraham went into Canaan. So I think I said two, it's actually three. Adam, Methuselah, Noah, and Shem. So between Adam and Abraham, there's three people. So it's a very short line to hear the firsthand story of the single God that created the world, the story of the Garden of Eden, how they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, how the world was destroyed by flood. It's a very short line of people, if they could have known each other. Again, we continue through time. God called Abraham. Abraham and Lot left. And Lot went and chose the land of Sodom and Gomorrah because it looked like a nice place to live. Something happened there. There was four Babylonian kings that came and overtook Sodom, where Lot lived, and they took him captive. Abraham found out about it, and he went and he defeated all four of those Babylonian kings, which they were probably city kings at the time, so it's not like a huge kingdom, but nonetheless, defeated four Babylonian kings. And on his way back, he met a man named Melchizedek. Now, this is a very, very interesting character. There's a lot of thought as to who Melchizedek was, because it said that he was the priest, the high priest, or the priest of God, and in Hebrews he is compared to Jesus, and he was a high priest, and Christ is actually our high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So to understand Christ, you have to wonder, who was this Melchizedek person? Some believe, and I'm leaning this direction myself, that Melchizedek was very likely Shem. Because Shem was the one that Jesus descended from. Shem lived 75 years after Abraham went to Canaan. And Salem, he was also known as the king of Salem. Salem was later renamed Jerusalem. And so knowing the genealogy and that Jerusalem was the home of God's people, it makes sense, even though we can't say for sure that that's who it was, but it's very possible that it could have been Shem. And Abraham paid tithes to Shem of all that he had received from the defeating of the Babylonian king. When Abraham was called by God, he was promised a son, and he was promised that of his seed would be many nations made. Well, Sarah, his wife, got a little antsy about the situation because they're getting old now. They're getting on up in years because Abraham was 70 when God made him his promise. They're getting on up in years, and they still don't have a son yet. Abraham and Sarah both believe that they're past the childbearing years, that they are no longer at a time where they can have children. So Sarah, in her concern about the fact they didn't have a son yet, she gave Abraham Hagar, her handmaid, and Ishmael was born of Hagar. And later we find out that God said that Hagar, or that Ishmael, was not the one that the promise would be through, that he would have a son after that time. Sarah then was very upset at what she had done about Hagar and Ishmael. So she sent them away. But God promised Ishmael that a great nation would be made of him, and of his descendants come the Arabians, the Arabs. From Isaac's descendants come the Jews and the Israelites. And those two fought. And you know what? They're still fighting, even to this day. And I don't think we're going to stop them. I don't believe that we will stop them. And if you look at it in the whole big picture, it's actually very arrogant of the United States to believe that we can go in and stop a war that's been going on since the time of Abraham. God revisited Abraham and Sarah and renewed the covenant with them. And he made the covenant with them, and the sign of the covenant was circumcision. So Abraham and all of the male that were with him were circumcised. And he renewed the vow with them that they would have a son. We continue through time, and word comes to Abraham that God is planning to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. So Abraham negotiates with God, and I find this very interesting, that Abraham actually negotiated with God. He said, God, if you find 50 people who are righteous, will you spare it? He said, I will. He said, don't be mad at me, but what about 45? He said, okay. He said, okay, don't be mad at me, what about 40? Okay, I still won't destroy it for 40. Don't be mad at me again, what about 30? What about 20? What about 10? And God said, I won't destroy it for 10 people. And they couldn't even find 10. Couldn't even find 10. And so Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed in Genesis 19. Abraham and Sarah are given the son as God promised. And finally, Isaac being born, God asked something very strange of Abraham. He said, I want you to go and sacrifice your son. And he told him to go to Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah was a three-day walk. Now imagine that. You have to take your son, walk for 3 days to a mountain to sacrifice. Your son doesn't know what, but you have to take him. And when you get there, you have to lay him on the altar and kill your son and offer him to God. How much faith would that take? It would take a lot. And we understand that Abraham has faith enough in God that he could raise up of him another son. He gave him Isaac even though that they were past childbearing years, and he had faith that he could give him another son. And so he went through with it to the point that he had a dagger up in the air. And the angel of the Lord called him and told him to stop. And he knew that he would be faithful to God from his actions there. Isaac grows up, and he seeks a wife. Abraham made a big deal about Isaac not taking a wife of the Canaanites. The Canaanites descended from Ham, and Ham from the start was not a very righteous man, and his descendants were not either. And so Abraham did not want Isaac's wife to come from his line. So he made a big deal about it to the point that he did not even want him to go back into the country to take a Canaanite wife. And so he sent someone to look for him. The man that he sent found Rebekah. And Rebekah bore him Esau and Jacob. Esau was real hungry one day, and Jacob asked him if he was selling his birthright for a piece of meat. He said, what good is it for me? Because if I don't eat, I'm going to die. So he sold him his birthright. He regretted it later, but he couldn't get it back. Again, later in their life, Jacob went in to Isaac and deceived Isaac so that he could receive the blessing of the firstborn. So Jacob has now obtained the birthright and his father's blessing. Well, that upset Esau pretty good. And so his father told him to flee from Esau and to go to be with his brother Laban. It was actually his brother-in-law. It was his wife's brother. So Jacob travels about 400 miles north to go to be with Laban. On the way, he was sleeping one night. Something strange happened. He had a dream. You know what his dream was? He dreamed that he saw a ladder stretching from the earth to heaven. And angels were ascending and descending on that ladder from heaven to earth. And we understand that to be that from the line of Jacob would be the bridge made between man and God. But before that, there was no bridge. But through the line of Jacob, through his descendants, would the Messiah come that would make the bridge for mankind to God. After much deception on the part of Laban and much controversy, Jacob has a polygamous family of two wives, two concubines, 12 children, 12 sons, and one daughter. And they are told by God to return to the promised land. On the way back to the promised land, one night, Jacob wrestled with an angel. Some translations say that he wrestled with God all the night long. And it says could not prevail. And I believe what it means there is that the being that he was wrestling with did not prevail over him, because the angel said, "Let me go." And he said, "I won't let you go unless you bless me." He was going to make sure that he got a blessing before this being, whether it was an angel or whether it was God or Christ or whomever it was a being sent on behalf of God. He was not going to let that person go until he received a blessing. It's interesting. The angel says the hollow of his thigh. And later we read that Jacob was limping because of that. It knocked his hip out of socket. And from that day, Israel, there was a part of the meat that Israel would not eat, because that was the place where their father Jacob had been touched by the angel. On the trip back, they come through a country, a city of a man named Shechem, however you would like to pronounce it. This man saw Dinah, the only daughter of Israel, and he thought she was beautiful. And he took her, and it says he defiled her. He lay with her. Most likely he raped her. Well, that upset Jacob's children. It upset them so bad that they deceived this people. And it was very brutal what they did to them. They went in to them, and this man says, "I love your daughter. She's beautiful. Give her to me to be my wife." And they said, "We can't marry with you, and you can't marry with us because you are not circumcised. But if you will have all the male of this city to be circumcised, we will marry with you, and you can marry with us, and our materials will be yours, and we will share possessions, and we will share the land." And he loved her so much that he had every male there circumcised. 3 days later, when they were quite immobile and very sore, Simeon and Levi went in and slew all the males of the city and took the wives, the children, and all the possessions to spoil. Well, that upset their dad pretty good. He says, "You've made me to stink in the eyes of the countrymen." But God placed fear on all of the other countrymen, the other cities. He placed the fear of Jacob, the fear of Israel on them, and none of them would go to battle with Israel. And he passed through the country. Now, Jacob loved Joseph. Why did Jacob love Joseph so much? Joseph was the firstborn of Rachel. And if you remember the story, Rachel was the wife that he initially agreed with Laban to work for. He was going to labor for him 7 years, and then he would be given Rachel. But Laban deceived him and gave him Leah. And there was controversy there all the time, even throughout the years of the tribes. There was controversy from their descendants. But Joseph was the firstborn of Rachel, the wife that he loved. And he loved Joseph. He gave him a coat of many colors, and it made the older brothers jealous. Not only this, but Joseph dreamed a dream one day that his brothers would look up to him, that they would bow down to him. Well, all of this together was just too much for him, apparently. And they decided they were going to kill him. Judah stood up and said, "No, don't kill him, let's sell him." And they sold him into slavery. They sold him into slavery into Egypt. And Joseph remained faithful to God. While he was in Egypt, God blessed Joseph because he was faithful. He was in Potiphar's house. Potiphar noticed that with Joseph there, that everything was successful, that everything went well. And so he set Joseph over everything in his house. He gave him power over all of his possessions, everything except his wife. His wife was the only thing that he kept back from Joseph. And Joseph wouldn't have anything to do with her anyway because she was his wife. But she liked Joseph. And she wanted to lay with Joseph. She wanted to be with him. And she tried and tried to convince him, and he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't be with her. Well, one night Joseph came in the house to do some work. None of the other men in the house were there. I think that was fairly convenient for Potiphar's wife. I almost would believe that she planned it that way. Because while he was there, it says that she grabbed him and was going to take him in and lay with him. And Joseph ran. He fled. But there was something left behind. She grabbed his coat. And it says that he fled and ran out naked from the house. He wasn't going to have anything to do with it. So, of course, to protect herself, she turned it against Joseph. She says, look, he was here. The Hebrew was here. And he tried to lay with me, and I yelled, and I screamed, and he left, and he left in such haste that he left his clothes behind. So she turned it against Joseph. Potiphar got upset, threw Joseph in prison. Poor Joseph. He's had a rough life. His father's favorite. His brothers don't like him, so they think about killing him. Then they sell him into slavery. God raises him up, only for him to get thrown back into jail again. But he remains faithful. He remains faithful. While he's in prison, he meets a man that was a butler and a baker for the Pharaoh of Egypt. Each one of these men had a dream one night. They couldn't figure out what the dream meant. They couldn't interpret it. The baker had a dream that there were three vines. And out of the three vines, there were grapes. And he took of the grapes, and he pressed the grapes into Pharaoh's cup, and he gave them to the Pharaoh. The other had a dream that he had three baskets on his head, and in the top of the basket, the third basket was lots of bread, and that the birds came down and were eating the bread from the basket. Well, Joseph interpreted the dreams this way, that the baker would, within 3 days, be restored, that Pharaoh would raise him up and restore him to his position. He would once again stand before the Pharaoh to be able to, just as the dream said, press the grapes and give him his cup to do what the dream had said that he would do. But of the butler, that within 3 days, Pharaoh would raise him up, he would be hanged, and the birds would eat his flesh. And it came true. And Joseph asked the baker to remember him when he was set free. Well, the baker forgot for a while. So one day, Pharaoh had some dreams. And in these dreams, what happened was, there was two actually. In the first one, there were seven cows that came up out of the river. They were fat cows, nice, pretty, full, plump cows. Plenty to eat. They were doing real well. Well, then seven skinny cows came out, and they ate the seven fat cows. And even when they were finished eating, they still looked famished. Well, then he woke up. He was disturbed. He went back to sleep and had another dream. And in the second dream, there were seven full ears of corn that grew. And then there were seven ears of corn that grew that were blasted by the east wind, it said. And the seven that were blasted by the east wind devoured the seven full good ears. Nobody could interpret the dream. All of a sudden, the baker remembers, hey, there was a Hebrew that was in the prison. He had actually been made the keeper of the prison. That was in the prison that interpreted my dream, and I think he could interpret yours as well. So they bring Joseph out. He cleaned himself up. It says he shaved and cleaned up and changed his clothes, and he went in before the Pharaoh. Well, of course, he interpreted the dreams to be that there would be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. The Pharaoh believed him. The Pharaoh raised Joseph up, and Joseph was made the second in power to everything in the land of Egypt. The only way that the Pharaoh was higher than Joseph was in the throne. Other than that, Joseph had the equivalent power of the Pharaoh of Egypt. So the famine sets in. Joseph's family comes to Egypt. Why did they come? Because of the famine. For 7 years of plenty, they stored up all the food in Egypt, and then 7 years of famine came across all the land. Jacob and his family got hungry. They heard that there was food in Egypt. And so he sent his sons, except for Benjamin, he sent all his sons except for Benjamin to Egypt to buy food. And they meet Joseph there. And he recognizes him, but he doesn't make himself known to them. He spoke in the Egyptian tongue. He could understand them. He still knew the Hebrew language, but they didn't know who he was, and they didn't recognize him. No doubt he had grown up a lot. He was a young lad when they sold him into slavery. And also, I'm pretty sure his attire had changed since he was now the second in command in Egypt. So he was dressed different, he was grown up, he was speaking the Egyptian language, and they didn't know who he was. After a few trips back and forth of Joseph asking him to bring Benjamin to see him, and then they sent him back to get his father, Jacob and the family finally come to Egypt. Jacob dies, asked to be carried back to be buried with his fathers, and Joseph dies and asks for his bones to be transported and buried in the land of his inheritance, in the promised land. So Jacob's children, Israel's children, are now in Egypt. They're in Egypt under a Pharaoh that remembers Joseph, under a Pharaoh that knew Joseph, and that blessed them. And they were successful. They were fruitful. Everything they did was fruitful. They multiplied, and they became many in number. And this leads us to the book of Exodus, which is where Dad will pick up tomorrow night. Because now the family is in Egypt. Now the family is in Egypt. Now God's plan is ready for what we're going to see tomorrow night, which is for God to show His power and to show that He is the one true God above all other gods that have ever been created. He is able to show His power to bring Israel as a nation out of Egypt. So if you had to say what the themes were for the book of Genesis, what would you say are the themes? Disobedience versus obedience. There are many stories of obedience to God, but from the beginning was disobedience with Eve. God gave us free will, but He expects us to freely give that will back to Him. He didn't make us robots. He gave us free will to make and choose our own decisions, and we see many choices through this book, through this beginning book of the story of God and man, that people made some good, some bad. But we have to be obedient to God. The idea of sin versus perfection. You know, we think that many times we may have the idea that to be used by God, we have to be perfect. That's not at all true, because Noah got drunk, Sarah doubted God, Jacob had many wives, he used deceit to gain his position from Isaac, from his older brother Esau, from Isaac. So there's lots of things that in the Old Testament stories where these people didn't do what was right, didn't do what was acceptable to God. But in the big picture, they gave their heart to God. They gave their faith to God. They gave their trust to God. And when God said to do something, they did it. So we've made mistakes. Some of us have made the same mistakes that we just talked about. We've done the same things. We've made the same sins. We've done some of the same things they did. And God can still use us if we will put ourselves in His hands. There's a lot of promises. And the promises are reiterated over and over and over in this book. And throughout the New Testament, the Old Testament, we'll see how the promises are renewed. And they're reminded of the promises of God. They're reminded that God brought them out of Egypt. They're reminded of all these things. But we have promises too. One of my favorite chapters in the Bible is Romans chapter 8. There's five beautiful promises that we can hold on to in that chapter. Beautiful promises that we can hold on to. So what can we take home with us tonight from this discussion? God is with those who trust in Him. If we trust in God, it doesn't matter what we face, we can withstand. Ask Joseph. Joseph did it. Joseph trusted in God. And all the bad that Joseph went through, God turned it into good for him, didn't He? He was thrown into slavery by his brothers. He was deceitfully thrown into jail by Potiphar's wife. And then he was raised to power by the Pharaoh. God can turn anything into good if we will put our trust into Him. God always knows best. Sometimes we don't understand. We don't understand. God told Noah to build an ark. They'd never seen rain before. Why was they building an ark? What is rain? They didn't know what it was. But did Noah question him? Did it have to make logical sense? You know, today if God told us to build an ark and gave us the same dimensions, we'd say, hey, you know what? That thing's not going to float. You need some kind of a boat shape on the bottom, not a matchbox. You need something that's going to float. We would have tried to correct him. Noah built it just like he said, and it worked. God knows best, and God's plan should not be questioned. And we're going to see that plan unfolding throughout this week, how that God has taken a man, Abraham, made a promise to him, and through his descendants created a family, moved that family to Egypt, and now he's ready to bring that family as a nation out of Egypt. So let's think about the story of God and man. I pray that you'll come back through the week to hear more of the story. And again, I say that I hope that you fall back in love with these stories again as if it was the first time you heard it. And remember, the story of Christ is the greatest story that's ever been told. No other story compares to his story. And let's remember that. We're going to stand now and sing a song of invitation. If there's any way that we can be of assistance to you this evening, if you want to join the church, you want to become a member of the family of God, that we're going to continue to learn about through the rest of these stories, and you want to be one of his children, you can do that tonight. If you believe that Jesus Christ is his son, and he did rise from the grave, he did go to the cross, you believe it and you're ready to confess that belief, repent of your sins, and be baptized, you can do that tonight. You can go on your way rejoicing like the eunuch did in the story of Philip. If you have done that and you've fallen away and you want to come back, you want to come back and make things right with God before it's too late, you're welcome to do that as well. We can help in any way we can while we're standing sing.
Okay.